Accession number 30624, Reel 4.
Accession number 30624, Mr. Murray Pevan, Reel 3. Now, your next thing then is you left there in April 1943, and you're going to the next stage, which is number...
Heaton Park.
Oh, you go to Heaton, that's not on here, right.
No, wait a minute. No, sorry, stop. We went to grading school at Cambridge.
It says 22 elementary...
That's right, elementary flying training school. That was the great thing. What happened was this, and you've got to look at the beginning of my logbook.
I will, yeah.
The system was that all aircrew that had passed the appropriate exams at their ITWs then went to what is known as a grading school, where you were given 12 hours of elementary flying training instruction to decide whether or not you had aptitude as a pilot. And if you didn't, you were shunted off sideways, navigation, wireless operator, air gunner, any other air trade. And the name of the game was to get through grading school.
All right. So, carry on. So where was it? This is actually at Cambridge.
At Cambridge.
22 EFTS.
Yes, 22 EFTS, and that is the...
Keep going. They can't see, remember. Carry on talking.
That's it. There it is.
So tell me, how do they start you with flying?
Well, the first of all, they issue you a flying kit.
Right. Tell me what that is.
It's a big zip-up, one-piece flying suit, helmet and boots.
Was it the Sidcut still?
Sidcut, yes, and gloves, yeah. And you're being taken up in a flying, in a Tiger Moth. And what happened?
Now that's the DH-82A, yeah.
So the very first day, we were taken down in a group called flight number, whatever it was, and we were marched down to a dispersal Cambridge airfield, and there were some tough looking sergeant pilots and a bunch of very rickety looking aeroplanes, and it was a production line basis. Right, next one forward in the back there, right, next minute strapped in, and the thing was rumbling away and taking off. And I decided to myself then and there that if I wanted to be a pilot, I had to impress that sergeant.
Now that sergeant was Sergeant Lovell.
The first name there, yeah.
Yeah.
And I had to get on with Sergeant Lovell, and I had to make Sergeant Lovell love me. And we went up, and of course what the bastard did, I mean, they were doing this all day long, every day. They were sick to death of it. So they all used to meet over some place or other and go have dogfights. Absolutely scare the brand new pupil stiff, the person who'd never been in an airplane before. Remember, you're sitting in the back of a Tiger Moth with a bit of plywood on either side of you, and beyond the plywood is space. And you just look over the side, and there's nothing between you and the ground. And there's this funny voice coming through a bit of rubber tube.
The Gosport tube.
Yes, into your ear. And you didn't know what the hell's going on. And the world is spinning around you, the sun, the sky, the ground. And what I thought to myself, but the guy's got a mirror. And I thought, Murray, be clever. Grin. Smile. Look like you're enjoying it, which is what I did. So I got on with Sergeant Lovell.
So he was just flinging it about. And this was your familiarisation.
Put the shit up. You.
And this is your familiarisation.
The first day, the first trip, they put the shit up you. And I came down and said, how do you feel? I said, fine. When can we start learning? And I think those are the wisest words I ever said.
Now, so how do they start? What's the program that they take you through? I know you later on become a pilot, an instructor, but
what
do you remember of the way they did it there?
Well, I think the RAF were experts at flying training. They knew their business inside out. And after 12 hours of flying here, you then were sent off.
Hang on, so going back to that, so what did they actually do in that 12 hours that they gave you? How did they start you to teach you to fly?
I would say they were very efficient at teaching you how to basically fly an aircraft, a simple aircraft, because in looking back at the logbook entries for that time, because my memory doesn't go back that far, I can see from what I know now, that the lessons they gave you were progressive and showing you how to gradually acquire knowledge of how to fly the aircraft and take it off and land it, which was crucial. There's the first grade of test here after you've done about 8 hours, then further test, and then a final test by the squadron leader, which obviously I passed.
Now, I think the best way then is to turn it round so that you explain it. So, if you take us through a Tiger Moth then, what were the characteristics of a Tiger Moth?
Well, it was a very basic aircraft. It was an open aircraft. It was a biplane. It was slow, but it was safe. And the thing about it was they had lots of them. And that's why it wasn't the best trainer of all. The Germans had a far better trainer. The best man, which is similar in configuration, but a far, far better aircraft. But we had lots of them, and they're available then. And it was made by one manufacturer, de Havilland, who also made the engine. So it all came out of one factory.
Now, what are the flying instruments and controls that you got? You got into your cockpit. You're behind the instructor?
Yes, you sit at the back, and the instructor sits at the front, so you can't see straight ahead. So you've just got your standard instruments, which are your airspeed indicator. You didn't have an artificial horizon in those days. You had a great big Reading Sigrist turn and slip, which was a gigantic big circular instrument with two needles, and the bottom one showed you whether you were turning, and the top one told you whether you were flying straight in other words, you weren't slipping to one side or the other. Then you had your altimeter, important. Then you had your direction indicator, which was your magnetic compass, and then you had your rev counter. And I think that was about all there was in the Tiger Moth. It's probably oil pressure, oil temperature, things like that, but I can't really remember.
No, that's fine. Now, what about your controls? You've got
your stick control, and your stick was in the centre, and your stick controlled the aircraft in pitch, that's nose up, nose down, in roll, that's turning to the right or turning to the left, and also rudder bar, which controlled the aircraft in yaw, which meant which pointing to the left or pointing to the right. So you had all three axes under control. You had your throttle on one side. You also had a trim, because at different air speeds, in order to get the aircraft to generate the amount of lift that will equal its weight, you had to have a different angle of attack of the wings to the air, and that was achieved by moving the trimmer so that the aircraft went at the required angle of attack. The higher the speed, the more the lift, therefore the nose came down, otherwise you'd start to climb. If you want to fly straight and level, then the thing has to be in balance in all directions.
If we look at the different parts of a flight, which obviously you're learning in these lessons, what about taxiing and take-off? What are the skills in taxiing
was very difficult, because you had a skid at the back of the thing, not a tailwheel. And you, more or less, you had to keep swerving from one side to the other, because you couldn't see straight ahead, because as it was a tailwheel aircraft, the nose of the aircraft was right up in the air, and that plus the instructor in front meant you couldn't see straight ahead. You could only see to one side or the other. So in order to avoid taxing into something, you had to turn the aircraft each side of your intended direction of travel, so you could look one side or the other out of the aircraft. And that was difficult, as I say, because you didn't have a steering tailwheel. So to start you off, you had a wing walker at each side, and then once you got to the hang of it, you taxi on your own.
So, now take off. What you have to do and remember as you're taking off?
To take off, what you have to do is, let's go back to the basic principle. An aircraft in stable flight, in a stable direction, a stable altitude, has got four forces acting on it. The one is its weight. Let's say it weighs a ton. You've got to have lift of a ton. If the lift is more than a ton, you'll climb. If the lift is less than a ton, you'll descend. So in stable flight, you've got your lift has to equal your weight, whatever the aircraft is. Now, you've also got drag caused by the wind being used, A, to create lift, and also the drag of the aircraft moving through the air. So you have to have thrust. So to maintain a constant airspeed, the thrust has to equal the drag. If the thrust is bigger, higher than the drag, you'll accelerate. If the thrust is lower than the drag, you'll slow down. So you've got all these forces equal and opposite to each other. Now, the lift is acquired by a wing moving through still air. Now, it has a slight angle of attack. In other words, the front end of it is slightly higher than the back end. And if you think about it, the wind striking the underneath gives it a little bit of a push up, and also flowing over the top of the wing, which is rounded, it also has a lower pressure on top, which allows the wing also to rise. So the total effect of these two generates a thing called lift. Also, there is another theory, and that is Newton's third law of motion, which says that any force operating in one direction has an equal and equal force operating in the other direction, which means that if you want to go have lift up, you've got to have a force going down. So very sophisticated people now say it's now due to Newton, not due to the shape of the wing, but I think it's a combination of both, actually. Thinking slightly more widely, if you imagine a great big jet weighing about 300 or 400 tons going down the runway, suddenly with one just tiny movement of the control column back, it suddenly acquires enough lift to equal that weight and to take it climbing into the air. Now, something magic has taken place as it's gone down the runway, but it hasn't changed its shape or form. All it's done is acquire speed. So at a certain speed, enough lift is generated for it to lift up. But on the other hand, if you look at one of these things in a drizzly day and see the air flows coming back, you can see gigantic plumes of steam, if you like, coming downwards, hitting the ground, and that is providing the thrust.
That's a fantastic, I mean, that really does help. Now, so what you have to remember as you're taking off, I mean, here you are, we're talking about, you know, during the first 12 hours.
You're doing, basically, you're acquiring airspeed, and as the speed increases, you lift the tail up, so you're going straight across the ground. Speed's increasing, you're keeping it straight by use of your rudder, so you keep heading in the right direction. Then when it gets us to a certain airspeed, you ease gently back on your joystick, I call it the stick, and what happens is the aileron at the back lifts up, the airflow over that forces the tail down, that makes the nose come up, and then for a moment in time you're still going straight across the ground, but in a different attitude, and the attitude is that the wings are now hitting the air at an angle, and this generates lift enough for it then to start taking off and climbing.
And what you have to remember,
you've got to watch that your airspeed doesn't reduce too slowly and that you stall.
Now, if you stall, there's something you're always told not to do.
Yeah, go back further on the stick. Well, the thing is this, it depends what type of aircraft. I mean, a heavy aircraft, heavily laden, what you would do in practice is it's different to the Tiger Moth. The moment you get off the ground, you would then start straight and level with the ground until you increased your speed sufficiently that you could start climbing with safety, you'd have a safety margin. Whereas today, the modern jets, they go straight back and straight up because they've got such fantastic thrust. We never had such an amount of thrust
now,
in those days.
Were you told not to try and turn back if you were stalled?
Oh no, you're talking about once you're up in the air. Once you're up in the air, you've taken off into wind, obviously. So if you're going to turn back, in the turn, you're going to lose so much height that it's doubtful if you'll be able to get back all right. Now, you're trained to try and land. If your engine fails on takeoff, 30 degrees each side is the maximum you're allowed to turn or taught to turn, and you've got to find some place in that arc in which it's safe for you to land.
Somewhere flattish.
Or at least, put it another way, least dangerous. Certainly not safe.
Now, when you've got off, take me through a typical flight. Then.
Yeah, what you do, in the early days, you're learning circuits and bumps.
Now tell me.
Going around the airfield and landing, and you do circuits and bumps until you're bloody proficient before they let you go anywhere off the airfield.
Now, so basically what you're learning there is the takeoff, now, and going around in circuits.
Well, the thing, a circuit and bump actually encompasses all the different types of flight you're going to experience. The downwind, which is going back to where you started from, if it's extended, becomes your cruise, your flight. In other words, you take off, you turn onto a heading at right angles with your takeoff direction.
Now tell me how you turn, just, you know.
You turn by easing your stick slightly to, let's assume you're turning to the left. You achieve your airspeed, then you push your stick over to the left, and your turn starts. As you're turning, you ease your stick slightly back, because in the turn, your wing has acquired an angle, therefore its lateral distance has reduced slightly, so it's generating less lift, so you have to come back slightly on the stick, and watch your airspeed to see your airspeed is maintained, your power, and see that you're not slipping or skidding by use of your rudder and your slip ball, and you keep going around watching the compass until you are at right angles to your original direction of flight. And then you proceed for a certain distance, and then you make another turn to the left, and then you become what is known as downwind. In other words, you're exactly the reciprocal of your takeoff direction, and you clean up your act in getting your cruise, as it were, nicely done. Your trim, your airspeed, your engine revs, your instruments, everything's working nicely, you're in control, and then go down the downwind, and then when you're at roughly 45 degrees from your original takeoff position, the start of the runway, you make another turn, which is onto what is known as base leg, and there you ease back on the throttle, and you let your speed reduce, you retrim to a landing speed, and then you start getting ready for your actual final turn on and your landing. Now, in a simple aircraft like the Moth, you don't have flaps or anything like that, the sort of sophisticated devices you have today. So it's basically a simple thing of getting your airspeed back, getting it trimmed for lower airspeed, and watching for your the end of the runway, a position at which you will flare, that is, level out and get the aircraft slowly down onto the ground. Now, because you can't see it ahead, you do a turning final leg, the Spitfire turn it's known as, and you're judging with your eye. The wind is blowing you back, maybe you're descending too quickly, a little bit more power, maybe you're too fast, maybe you're too slow. Constantly your mind is acting as a computer, engaging with the picture that is being presented to it by the runway, your relationship, your position in relationship to that runway, and whether an imaginary straight line from you to there is being followed by your airplane. And with experience, you do this automatically, you don't even think about it. And eventually you arrive over the end of the runway, and you easing back on your throttle, you close your throttle, and then because the aircraft will then want to come down even more quickly, back on the stick, and as your speed decays, by going back on the stick, you're bringing the nose up, you're increasing your angle of attack so that lift is maintained, and then right at the very last moment, you should be just a few inches above the ground, right back to the back, your throttle closed, your stick right back, and the aircraft should settle down, hopefully, on three wheels all at once. And you've done a three-point landing. And you then slow down.
With a tying off, it would be
two wheels and a skid.
I know you know.
But the thing is, that's how it should be.
How was your first landing?
Well, bloody awful, of course, like everybody else's.
So what are the common errors that you made?
The commonest error for any pilot is resisting, if the thing bounces, is resisting the temptation to push the stick forward to lower the nose. Because what will happen then is the nose will go forward, you'll immediately lose lift, you'll come down, and you'll bounce. Now, because the centre of gravity is in front of the centre of pressure, that's the centre of lift, what will happen then is that it will bounce, the nose will go up in the air, you'll acquire lift, you'll go up 2 or 3 feet, the tail will come down, the tail will hit the ground, and because it can't go any further, the nose will come down with a bang, the tail will come up, and you can either go over on your nose, or some calamity will happen, or else you'll just have a series of bunny pops across the runway. None of them satisfactory.
Now,
I'm not as fluent in my talk through as I was 65
years ago. Of course not. Of course not. You're pretty fluent anyway. Now, so that was that's circuits and bumps, and that's what you do.
You do those all day long, every day, until you've got them absolutely right.
And then what's the next step? What else do you have to learn? This is in the 12 hours, remember? So
well, in the 12 hours, you more or less did circuits and bumps. A few of them were allowed to go solo, but it was still just a circuit and bump solo.
Did you go solo?
No, I did not.
No, right.
So I'm surprised that I was approved as a pilot, given that I didn't go solo.
Now, tell me about the grade. You had two grading flights. They're in the
test. Two grading tests, yeah.
What were the grading tests?
Your general attitude and control. He'd take you up. We'd do a little bit of aerobatics and things like that, manoeuvres in the sky. Right, Pevin, I want to see a stall from straight ahead. I want to see you do a spinning, of course, things like that.
But I thought you hadn't done them.
Well, yes, I think it's in the thing. I think spins are there. I can't remember.
So it wasn't just circuits and bumps then?
Well, no. Spinning, exercise 10. Let's have a look. Exercise 10. 10, my third lesson I did spins.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that's all right.
As I say, I can't remember, but it's all down here on paper if you want me to read it off.
No. So what about...
Now, here we go, look. On the 17th, I did two left and two right spins.
Now, tell me about spinning, because you have to learn how to recover from a spin before you're allowed to go solo, I presume.
Also did low flying, I can see here. Now you're giving me the chance to read this, and to read this, I can see I did low flying, which is brilliant. I did spins. Yeah, it's all coming back now. It's pretty comprehensive.
Now, tell me about the spinning, then.
Spinning is... they don't teach private pilots spinning anymore, which is a shame. But spinning is something that was discovered in the First World War. And what it is a peculiar aerodynamic effect takes place if, when you are stalling in the air, losing airspeed, you apply excessive rudder. And that creates a situation where the aircraft loses lift on one wing, the inner wing. And have you seen these plants, what they call the seeds, what this called?
I've forgotten that, but they'll know what you mean.
Yeah. It's a seed with a sort of half a wing attached to it, and it's nature's way of distributing the seeds to a wider place, and they flutter down and spin down. And it took a long time, an important exercise. It also gives you a feeling of control. You know how to control your aircraft. Put it this way. If you're a driver of a car and you don't know how to get out of a bad skid, then it shouldn't be on the road. Okay?
And it's the same with the spin. Now, how do you get out of the spin? Because they didn't know.
It depends on the aircraft. But generally, most aircraft today have to pass...
No, then.
Aircraft then. You're in a spin. The first thing to do is to apply full opposite rudder. And that should turn it from a spin into a dive. And from a dive, you're then able to recover just by easing your stick gently backwards so you can come out of a dive into level flight. But the spin could last 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or more revolutions, and you're losing height at a very, very great rate. And if you're just a few thousand feet up and you get into a spin and you can't get out of it, you're going to crash and kill yourself. So it was crucial to learn how to get out of a spin.
Now, what about low flying? Anything in particular about that?
Yeah, well, low flying was to teach you anticipation, wires, obstacles, navigation, because you can't see very far ahead, observation, control of your aircraft, and basically safety. But it was very exciting. It's very, very thrilling. But it's a very essential thing for a military pilot. And I can see here now, it was done as exercise 14.
Is that the last one?
You see, most of these exercises are 12 and 13. 12, that is 12 and 13 are basically circuits and bumps. Now, exercise 14 is spinning. Now, exercise 10, I beg your pardon, is spinning, and exercise 14 is low flying. So that last final test, before I went to my final test, I did a little bit of every single thing in the syllabus. There's the final test.
And that's with the squadron leader, Paddy Gore, I think.
I don't know who he is, but this is my instructor on the same day. He'd taken me up, obviously, on that
for a whole hour beforehand.
For an hour beforehand, and then I went up with him, who tested me for 50 minutes.
And this is all taking place in May, and you pass. You know,
yeah, I passed it, obviously.
Anything else happened? Any other stories of while you're there? Because I know you have things
we used to go into Cambridge at nights and have fights with the university boys.
Now tell me about that, because
they hadn't been called up, you see. So if you went into a pub, you know, there was a fight between them and you for the girls. We were so innocent, you know, just talking to a girl. They were a magic thing. They were different to us. They weren't human beings.
So
I remember all the girls in those days wore frocks with a little bow at the back.
So you were basically fighting with the students, yeah. Not big fights.
No, anyone would do, you know.
Anything else happened to you? Well, you weren't there long.
Weren't there long.
Just from late April to early June.
Yeah, they whistled you through that, and then they got you away.
Now, so what's the next stage?
The next stage was Heaton Park.
Is that 31 PDC?
Personnel Disposal Centre.
And that's Heaton Park in Manchester.
Heaton Park in Manchester, aye.
Now, what happened there?
Well, again, under canvas. And Heaton Park, because it was a park, had public toilets in it, and that's what you used. And it was grotty, and you were just lodged there, out of the way, to decide where you were going, because the Air Force trained its pilots in Canada, in Rhodesia, South Africa, and various other places, and England, right? But very few in England because of the dangers. And
what dangers? Sorry.
Well, the enemy. Thank you very much. I've written a piece on it. I wrote a piece on this a few years ago. Trained overseas with A, the weather, B, the petrol was there instead of having to bring it across the Atlantic, C, you were unchallenged by the enemy, and D, because the countryside was ideal for it.
Now, so what were you doing during your month there?
Just buggering about, waiting for a boat. The first thing we got there, we went to a great big thing, and there they handed out our assignations. We didn't know we'd passed our grading test till we got to Heaton Park. And of course we sat there with bated breath, waiting, pilot, so-and-so, 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 so-and-so. And you're waiting with bated breath. And because my surname starts with a P, I was right at the end of the queue. And then, you know, foul curses or jumping for joy. And then they still didn't tell us where we were going, because they had to keep it a secret. So more or less on the last day, they said, right, you, Canada. And I had a secret code with my father that we weren't allowed to tell anybody where we were going, but we could write letters. And I said, I'm hoping to see Uncle Barney in the near future. And Uncle Barney was Dad's brother who lived in Canada. And I was delighted. And then we were taken on a night train